probably 3 or 4 Chinese entities reach out to me saying, you know, around the same time, saying that they were interested in acquiring businesses that sell into Apple. Kind of a curious thing, right? So yes, there are clearly some strategies that are being prodded from somewhere.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. My guest is Brewer Stone, partner at San Francisco-based Enfluence Partners. He's a China specialist and works with emerging technology companies and their venture capital and private equity investors. This is a fast-paced, fascinating discussion, so buckle up. Our topic is Asia tech, and in particular, the rise of China's tech giants. Before delving in, I asked Brewer to characterize the work he does.
I'm an investment banker, but I'm kind of an odd investment banker. I've always said I do investment banking the hard way. I help companies that really want to raise capital, go public, find a buyer, to really position themselves, think through their story. I work very closely with management teams to understand the landscape, whether it's the capital markets landscape or the strategic landscape, figure out how they can realize the most value for themselves in the market, and then be their partner and advise them through that process of actually getting money in or a buyer in.
How do you get paid for that?
You get paid on success, by and large. You know, sometimes they'll pay a little bit up front, but by and large, it's all outcome driven.
So through the years, you've watched the China tech landscape change and shift and evolve. Let's go back to, let's say, you know, early 1990s, when there was this initial enthusiasm, opening up of China, an interest in what Western technology had to offer the China market to help it develop. Tell us a little bit about that time and that place and what you observed.
Well, let me tell you a little bit of a story. So I just finished working on corruption in China and India. And so I had kind of a, you know, pretty interesting wedge into the tougher areas of the market, but a pretty good understanding of how things were going. And I had been hearing about, you know, this guy named Barton Biggs, who was the head strategist of Morgan Stanley, who'd gone to China and come back maximum bullish. And I'd read about this guy, Daniel Tully, the then CEO of Merrill Lynch, who had said, if I could start my career over again, I'd go learn Chinese and move to China. So this was all pretty inspiring. I thought, hey, I can do that. In that context, I decided to go dive in with both feet into China. And I ran into a guy who turned out to be the CEO of Prudential Securities, and they were all pumped up about China. I said, hey, wait a minute, guy, this is a little more challenging than you think. So he said, you know, you might be the right guy for us to hire. Next thing I knew, I was on a plane to Shanghai. When I showed up there, the building we moved into had been, you know, Morgan Stanley had recently moved in, and they had literally raised the roof of the building in order to make for this huge office that they were setting up, where they thought they were going to do bond trading and everything else and put a tennis court on the roof. None of that ever materialized.
This was the Portman Hotel, which at the time was kind of like an oasis for expats living and operating in Shanghai, a big complex but with both hotel rooms as well as kind of long-term rental properties for expats, right?
Yeah, it was a multi-use property with a lot of offices and a big central atrium. It was kind of a beautiful building. Yeah. But they literally decided to remodel the building for themselves just so that they could accommodate all this.
Did they do that?
They did, but they didn't do any business out of it. I think it ended up being a complete sink. But
how long did they last before they kind of pulled up and returned to the U.S.?
Well, they continued to be in China. You know, like Goldman and so on, there was a lot of in and out over the years. They sort of got bullish and then paired back. And, you know, so there was these cycles that went on. But you know, they've been there consistently, and they've built a nice business, and there's a whole complex story there that probably we don't need to dive into. But you know, I was there with a smaller firm, and we had to find our own niche. And what was really fascinating was that there was just this incredible thirst, both for understanding the global capital markets and for understanding technology. I mean, I remember a couple of things. One, I gave a speech. I was asked to give a speech to the gathered glitterati of the Shanghai Stock Exchange about the difference between the market maker system and the specialist system on the New York Stock Exchange, you know, in Chinese, which I'd learned along the way. And there was just fascination with understanding how the international capital markets worked. I remember also on the tech side, we had, I think it was HP had a sort of an exhibition just right in front of our office. And it was just like some exhibition with a bunch of servers and things sitting around on tables and a few sort of mid-level guys coming to give a speech. And it was just jammed to the rafters. I mean, everybody was fascinated to understand how these global tech companies ticked and what they could get from them.
And to be fair, this is a country that was behind an iron curtain for 40 plus years. They were coming out. Deng Xiaoping was showing the way, and they said profit is good. So people
were hungry. They didn't have the information. This was almost pre-internet in many ways, so they didn't have access. The only thing they could do was just, you know, show up and try to learn what they could.
And they learned fast. Yeah. And that's the extraordinary part of the story.
Well, which is where we're going next, because this whole tech phenom is quite interesting. I mean, for years and years, Americans looked at China and said, well, you know, China is really a copy market. They really aren't spending time, you know, trying to innovate. They're just taking what we have, reverse engineering it and selling and building it and then selling it at price lower than ours. That's not necessarily the case today. But to help us understand how it evolved and why it evolved the way it did.
Well, fundamentally, you're right. There was a real sense that the highest return on human and financial capital was to copy. So take a company like ZTE. I remember sitting there, obviously, in the news of late.
This is the mobile phone manufacturer.
Big mobile phone manufacturer, huge global company now. When I went to see them, this would have been in the, you know, in the late 1990s. They had 7 development centers with something around 5,000 engineers, many of whom were professors who had been paid, you know, $500 a month, that they were tripling their salary and putting them to work on, you know, building better optical transceivers. And you would go into these places and they'd have Cisco boxes and all these other, you know, all the other equipment from all the other major manufacturers, and they'd be reverse engineering them and trying to figure out what they could learn from them. They'd be scouring all the global patents and understanding what they could learn. So yes, there was a very open effort to borrow and learn what they could from abroad.
And unabashed. I mean, it wasn't like they were trying to hide the fact that they were copying the technology. They just thought this is a stepping stone towards being able to innovate ourselves.
Exactly. They were, I mean, the leaders would be conscious. This, look, we're doing what we legally can to learn as much as we can about what's happened, what, you know, others have developed. But, you know, over time, obviously, you push against the limits of that. You get into, you know, to scale production, you find local needs in the market, and they move beyond it. And it took a number of years. Yes, there was a long history of copying. But many of these companies now have become true global innovators.
And they were manufacturing initially for the export market, manufacturing low cost base and sending to US, Europe. But at some point it started to shift as the China market grew and demand grew.
Well, so actually in the case of Huawei, another famous company in this area, they were a local switching company operating primarily in southern China. And they wanted to have new technology, so they started assimilating it from other countries. But they sold a lot locally, and then once they built scale, they've started to go abroad. But that was actually later. Most of them started initially. But you know, China has had one of the benefits that China has that I think is important to understand as a premise here is it's got a continental scale economy, and so you know, the areas that we really think of as being important to understanding China's role in innovation. Often go more to business model innovation. I think one of the things that's important to understand here is we use innovation really loosely. You know, we often think of it as patents and things of that sort. But in the end, the innovation that matters is the innovation that enables businesses to become big and profitable. And that can often be business model innovation.
Well, but before we get there, Brewer, also there is some controversy about the rules and regulations for foreign joint ventures operating in China. They had to surrender elements of their IP in order to sell to the domestic market. It's still an issue. The Trump administration has pointed this out, and other trade negotiators are saying, yeah, there was an issue, there was a problem with that. Now, that gave them the leg up in terms of their path towards innovation. But what do you think about that? Clearly it worked, and clearly they gained some insights from that. But that was a stepping stone, again, towards ultimate innovation of their own products and services.
So China's taken a very aggressive path, and I think regardless of what you think of Trump, I mean, there's some issues there. There's no doubt about it, and people in the business have known that for a long time. The whole national champion strategy and the strategies around building strong local businesses in each of these sectors has been very aggressive, and they've had strong rules to back it up, whether it's effectively subsidizing the local companies or creating rules for international participants. A fairly famous example was in wind turbine technology, where they forced they put out rules you needed 80% plus local content, and so a bunch of European companies in particular that had come to the market effectively were forced to train local partners in their intellectual property and ended up getting a much, much smaller piece of the local market than if the rules had been different. And there are plenty of other case studies of that. So yes, they've been very aggressive at forcing local content and other rules.
Yeah, if I remember that case, in fact, it was even worse. I mean, they took the point where China-made wind turbines now completely displaced, foreign-made, even those from this Dutch company, which you're referring to, they ultimately kind of pulled down and realized we can't sell in the market. Our point of entry is too complicated, hurdles are too high, and we're being blocked. The Chinese have a competitive advantage by virtue of being domestic.
Yeah, but part of it also, I mean, a similar thing, although complex stories, but is in the solar industry. But some of the story there was that there was a willingness and availability of capital, often subsidized loans or subsidized land access and things of that sort, that enabled these companies to go really big in scale. And just by, they would invest ahead of the market just on a wing and a prayer and without much. You know, China's also been different than the West in that during these building phases, a lot of companies haven't felt they needed really high gross margins. So their profitability didn't, they were all about get big first and then profitability can come later. And sometimes it never comes.
Right.
But in the meantime, they push all the international competitors out of the market because most of them don't want to operate at 10% gross margins.
Yeah. And this cuts across all areas. This is automotive, this is wind turbines and renewables. It's you name it, from in big, large industrial complex products right down to components and technology.
And think about it from a capital markets perspective. Your investors want returns on their investment. In the West, you've got a pretty high bar. If you want to get additional capital, you've got to have a return on that capital that's going to be higher than other opportunities. In China, there was an aggressive growth agenda driven by the government that said, okay, we don't need more than a 7% return on capital in order to make this make sense because we got a national objective. Mm. And that's competing against an environment where people want a 25 to 30% return on capital or whatever it may be, right? So that makes it harder makes it harder for international companies to compete.
Well, before we bring it up to the present, let's talk about the next phase. The next phase was when you actually had this movement where B2C companies emerged after the dot-com period. And for the first time, you had organizations that were trying to model themselves off what were already established global businesses, off eBay or Amazon or others, and trying to create a Chinese version of that. Can you tell us a little bit about those early examples and some of their successes?
This is a really fascinating part of the story because it was clear to all of us that the highest return on both human and financial capital was going to be taking models from the West and applying them in China. And of course, when you saw a business like Baidu emerge that was consciously copied after Google and then go public in the early mid-2000s and to huge returns, that really woke people up. Before that, though, one of the more interesting stories and consequential for the long-term end of the story, which was, there's a local business that was built up by a very smart guy called EachNet, he negotiated an acquisition by eBay. eBay had a global model where they charged commissions in selling C2C goods. And then this little company called Taobao, now known as Alibaba, came along and they set up a C2C marketplace. And Jack Ma was a pretty darn good salesman, talked people into giving him money on a strategy that was commission-free. Don't charge a thing, just build scale, all about scale. So obviously losing a lot of money in the course of doing that. And that basically drove eBay, EachNet. They couldn't get their shareholders to support that, a long-term strategy in that kind of competitive environment. So they backed down, and Alibaba now, owns 80% of the e-commerce market in China.
And that really wasn't any government stepping in or providing regulatory cover for them. It was really just a market strategy that was backed by investors who said, if you think you can scale fast enough, we're in.
Yeah, and people saw the big market and they saw an aggressive entrepreneur and they knew that the model worked elsewhere and they took a big bet and it paid off.
This is Inside Asia, and my guest is Brewer Stone, a member of San Francisco-based Enfluence Partners, a boutique investment bank specializing in technology, media, and telecom-related deals. In effect, Enfluence facilitates deals between tech companies and their venture capital and private equity investors. There's a lot more to talk about, so stay tuned. Let's get back to my conversation with Brewer Stone, partner at San Francisco-based Enfluence Partners, a boutique investment bank specializing in tech and media deals.
Where China has really been, I think, most innovative has been around business models. I think some of the famous cases, obviously Tencent. Think about games. Today, roughly 50% of global mobile and online games revenue comes from China. Mm. Huge percentage. And why is that primarily because Tencent innovated on this idea of in-game purchasing.
Explain that.
So basically, you know, when you're playing a first-person shooter game, you can buy a better gun, you buy some gems, you can buy a fancier gun and be able to kill people fast.
On the fly.
On the fly. And it's all inside the game. You don't have to pay anything to download the game. It's all free to play, as they say. But then you buy stuff to make yourself more competitive within the game.
And that's the business model. It's like basically purchasing, you know, peripherals in order to play the game better is the way that they build revenue.
Yeah, and they get you. You move you up your leaderboard with your buddies and you can shut them down and all that.
Yeah. You sound like a hardcore gamer here, bro.
Nah, man. I fooled around a little bit, but not so much. Yeah. It is amazing how they've innovated. And that was borrowed by Zynga and many others and has become the global standard now. Another really interesting one that's less well known is a company that we worked with in taking the public called YY, which has built what's now a $2 billion business, essentially compensating live broadcasters on both mobile and online platforms by their audience gifting them virtual items. So this is kind of a wacky thing. You think of like giving people digital roses and that's somehow going to work. But then they have a value and the broadcaster can actually get half of it and take it home. So they can actually make a living doing this.
Yeah. And digital roses never die.
They never die. Well, they might get pixelated or something.
Right. But and this is something which kind of feeds into this this millennial group that really is highly active on social networks and media and looking for fun, engaging, interesting things to do. Really no great, you know, business or commercial utility to it. It's just more of a feature of what it is to engage in social media in China.
Well, both in the games world and in the social media world, you need to realize that, something many people on surveys say that in China, 60% of people's social life is online. So it's, you can argue whether that's a good or bad thing, but that's the reality. And so people do a lot through their phones and social networks. And this is an important part with the way they engage others and just have fun when they're sitting at home in an apartment on what could be a not very beautiful day outside given pollution.
So the market is the petri dish. I mean, the very fact that it is a scaled market, a huge market, in many ways, these Chinese tech organizations will do just fine staying at home. Why would they choose to go global?
Well, because they can, because they're big. I mean, in the end, these companies are just generating massive amounts of profits now. If you look at, Alibaba or Tencent or Baidu, these are big profitable businesses. And it's very logical for them to think about where's my next wave of growth and be experimenting with going international. But it's tough. I mean, I think there's a lot of particularities to the Chinese market, and the experiments so far have been, frankly, mixed. We haven't seen a lot of success, so I think it can be hard for these guys to go global.
Which shows, you mentioned Baidu and Tencent and Alibaba. I mean, the fact that they did grow on the back of elements of protectionism. I mean, Google, Facebook, other kind of global social media search platforms have been blocked from China in order to give the domestic companies a run for their money. I mean, they claim it's for media censorship and other things like that, security, whatnot. But in effect, what they've been doing is protecting their own businesses and giving them the time to grow.
That's true. But at the same time, you have to realize that these companies have faced intensely competitive domestic markets. It was not a foregone conclusion that WeChat, the Tencent social media platform, was going to become the dominant player. When they came in, there was a company we also helped take public called RenRen, which people thought, was going to be the Facebook of China. They failed, and WeChat came in with a more mobile-centric, different model that worked a lot better. There was also Sina Weibo in that market as well. So there's always been local competition, and that's true in e-commerce as well. Alibaba's had other folks coming at various segments of its business right along, and they've had to compete. And that's where, fundamentally, if you look at how China transitioned from a copycat model, there was this big wave, as I've said before, of copycat models. But once they got to scale in the local market, it became about competition. It became about domestic innovation. And that's driven a fundamental change in the culture of these companies.
Yeah. And now we've got a phenomenon, Brewer, where these organizations are extremely wealthy. They've built profits, revenues, and they're going and acquiring globally. You're here in San Francisco. There is an enormous throughput of Chinese interest, Chinese organizations, China venture capitalists prowling around looking for deals in Silicon Valley among these up up-and-coming businesses. Is that because they're looking to kind of then feed this advanced technology, even leading into robotics, AI, and Elsa, back into their organizations? Or are they going to play the capital markets and simply buy because they now are wealthy enough to do so?
Well, circumstantial evidence would suggest that there's a policy behind this. You know, when you see 60 accelerators and innovation centers backed by Chinese companies set up in Silicon Valley over a three-year period, there's probably somebody telling them that this is a good idea and that they should be investing in it. You know, and
explain that. I mean, tell us a little more about that.
Well, I mean, you've just got so many of the major Chinese companies, and they do it, you know, frankly, partly because they want to learn and they want to be engaged with the international. So there's very legitimate reasons, but they bring in a certain amount of capital, they buy up real estate, they set up these accelerators, and then they invite all these local startups to come and work in their offices, and they learn from them. And the idea is to help with, you know, the big focuses in China are things like developing artificial intelligence, developing industry 4.0, you know, much more sensor-based automated industry. These are all things that are, you know, next generation telecommunications networks, new advances in security, et cetera. These are all things that they're important for any economy. And China is very, very specific and directed in its industrial policies for developing these things. And so, and part of that has been, you know, encouraging companies and probably rewarding them in the local markets for going out and investing in the West.
So there are a set of anointed China born companies which have a Chinese government endorsement backing, are they receiving funding and support or simply just being encouraged to go global? I mean, where does the government involvement begin and end to the best of your knowledge?
It's hard to say. It's frankly a bit opaque. I mean, many of these are government-run companies. An example would be Zhongguancun, which is, you know, the biggest tech center in Beijing. They've set up, their parent company has bought a building here in Silicon Valley. They've set up a fund of funds to invest in other venture funds. They've set up an accelerator to invite companies to participate in it, et cetera. I mean, that's a government-owned entity in the end, right? So there's ultimately an implicit policy behind that.
We complain and we talk all the time, the U.S. government talks about being blocked from entering the China market. But there have been a few recent examples in the U.S. where Chinese companies have been blocked from acquiring or partnering in the U.S. I think it was Huawei was basically was going to form a joint venture or was get into a joint venture with AT&T. And the U.S. government said, no, we were concerned about the listening capability of some of their technology. I think there was another example of a Texas-based payments platform that Jack Ma wanted to buy in order to kind of continue to accelerate his mobile payments capability, and that was rejected. So we're kind of playing tit for tat here, aren't we? I mean, we aren't entirely, like our market is completely transparent and open and yours isn't. We're now starting to kind of push back on China a bit.
We are, and I think, China's got within its rights to do everything it can to build successful tech economies. There's no doubt about that. But they are being aggressive. You certainly see efforts to move into our markets and perhaps to use unfair means to acquire to acquire technology. You know, as you say, Alibaba's acquisition of MoneyGram was blocked. That seemed a bit on the edge of what made sense, but it was on the grounds that they have access to a lot of financial networks and the like that could be strategic in the future. So the Trump administration has been pushing back harder than other administrations have historically. Mm-hmm. And it's an important debate. I mean, we should be eyes wide open looking at this, and both countries need to be thoughtful about their national interests and how to proceed.
And speaking about national interests, I mean, with the increase in the growth of China interests in Silicon Valley, what would you anticipate? What do you think the China companies, tech companies are looking for? I mean, is it the advanced future technologies, blockchain, AI, robotics, things that can help accelerate and grow their markets that they're most interested in? Or is it simply buying up peripherals or type of companies that are already feeding or selling to or set up in order to sell to the big U.S.-based companies like Apple or Google or others?
So there's been some interesting stories. I mean, one coincidence that I would mention on this, the last point, was that I had probably three or four Chinese entities reach out to me saying, around the same time, saying that they were interested in acquiring businesses that sell into Apple. Kind of a curious thing, right? So yes, there are clearly some strategies that are being prodded from somewhere to look at these kinds of options. There's a lot of interest in AI and robotics and what they call deep tech, without a doubt. So that's one end of the spectrum. But at the other end, some of the bigger companies are really looking for investments in great businesses that will grow and enable them to see new markets and enable them to hone their international strategy. Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu in particular, and to some extent others like Ping An, have pioneered a strategy of making minority investments as corporations, large minority investments, often at aggressive valuations in top emerging global businesses, so that they can play and not necessarily controlling those managers, so behaving almost like huge venture funds. That's something that most U.S. corporations don't do. They typically will say, your average tech buyer is going to say, I either want to own it and control it or not. Mm. Or they'll have a corporate venture firm that has a strategy, often about making small investments in early stage businesses. These guys are making big plays in bigger businesses in a more aggressive way without having control. And so they're taking different types of risks.
Just to have proximity to these new and emerging technologies in order to find out what it might do for them, either in support of building their businesses in China or in terms of how they can expand and grow globally. Is that right?
Yeah, and take an example of India. Alibaba now owns, or has a significant stake in most of the major, e-commerce businesses in the country. They own the biggest payments company, Paytm, and they're rolling out a payments and e-commerce strategy there. So there's a bunch of these kinds of things. Tencent's gone into a healthcare play called Practo, et cetera. So these guys are moving aggressively into new markets. And frankly, as I look from here, as a guy sometimes raising money for Silicon Valley companies, you can't ignore China, even if you understand there may be CFIUS issues, which is the organization that in the government that scrutinizes foreign direct investment for strategic reasons. But you can't ignore these guys. They've become a huge source of capital. All that money that's been generated. I mean, one of the fundamental things here, too, is there's been this huge rise of savings in China that's almost grown ahead of the size of their own capital markets. So you have sustained high valuations in the local market, both in the private market and in the public market side, which creates an arbitrage opportunity if you invest in companies here and then take them to China, right? So that's part of the logic of this too. You have to think of this as a multi-layered game. You've got the capital markets that ultimately drive the ship in many cases.
Mm. Brewer, it sounds like that call to China 30-some-odd years ago is paying off for you. I think it's a great choice, and it looks like you're thick in the game, so good luck to you.
Thank you so much. It's been fun, Steve.
This is Inside Asia, and you've been listening to my conversation with Brewer Stone, partner at San Francisco-based Influence Partners, a boutique investment bank specializing in cross-border tech deals. In reflecting on my conversations, I like to wrap up each show with an Asia Insider Minute, my attempt to summarize or shore up the conversation we've just heard. The key question is this: how concerned should Americans be about Chinese investment in U.S. tech companies? The Rhodium Group, an independent research organization that tracks global economic trends, says that in the past 4 years, China money has flocked to about 100 U.S. tech deals. That adds up to about $13 billion worth of investment. In dollar terms, it's only a drop in the bucket, but that's not the point. It's the nature of these deals that have some U.S. policymakers nervous. China-based investors appear to be targeting tech's cutting edge, investing in artificial intelligence, 3D printing, facial recognition, and military software. China may still lag the U.S. in terms of traditional tech in areas such as chip and semiconductor manufacturing, hardware and networking equipment, but it has accelerated and now surpasses the U.S. in next-generation tech categories, including e-commerce and mobility. In other words, rather than play catch-up, China is banking on its ability to break through to the next level of tech innovation. This shouldn't come as a surprise. Made in China 2025 is a government-sanctioned policy initiative to keep China out in front as the world's premier manufacturing center. Identifying and acquiring technologies to advance its cause is central to the policy. If providing a degree of protectionism for its homegrown businesses has been the plan for the past decade, China's push to invest aggressively in overseas tech is the call to action going forward. As Brewer points out, Chinese investors are making different kinds of investments and assuming new levels of risk to achieve those objectives. If they can design it, they will. If they can't, they'll buy it and deploy it at home. If you can make it there, says Stone, you can make it anywhere. Ambitious? Damn straight. But is it doable?
Partly yes, and partly no. In terms of enterprise-level technology designed to advance its manufacturing capability, the answer is most likely yes. China ranks among the most ambitious in the world when it comes to investment in robotics, advanced manufacturing, and supply chain innovation. While job security is a leading political hot potato in the U.S., and joblessness is a key indicator of a president's success, there's resistance to any innovation that threatens to displace people and increase unemployment. China, on the other hand, sees it differently. They've sacrificed before, and they'll sacrifice again. Better to invest in the future than to count on sunset industries to see their economy through. On the consumer side of the tech equation, China's prospects are less clear. For sure, to date, a combination of Chinese entrepreneurial tenacity, government protectionism, and cheap financing has underpinned the rise of a new generation of tech giant such as Alibaba, Tencent, and Baidu. The real test of success, however, lies beyond China's borders. Like Google, Facebook, and Amazon, China's tech upstarts will need to show that they too can operate cross-border and go global. Put more succinctly, only when Alibaba and Amazon go head-to-head will we know the degree to which Chinese government coddling has benefited the home team. If China Inc. is served as the proverbial nest, now is the time for China's consumer-focused companies to take wing. Whether they fall or fly depends on each individual company's commercial vigor and market innovation. Having said all this, let's get back to the original question. Is there indeed reason to fear China investment in U.S. tech? The answer, only if the U.S. fails to present a progressive industrial and tech policy of its own. And do we have one? Well, not really. For that, you have to ask Donald Trump. What do you think? Let us know by leaving us a comment on iTunes or visit us at our website at www.insideasiapodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein saying come in from the outside on Inside Asia.